Welcome to the OrthoClips podcast series, where we're going to discuss the latest hot topics and high-impact papers in orthopedic surgery. I'm your host, Saqib Rahman. Let's get this episode started. Today, I'm interviewing Dr. Noelle Van Rysselberg. She is an orthopedic trauma fellow at the Harborview Medical Center in Seattle, Washington. And we're going to talk about distal femur fractures. Specifically, we're going to speak about her paper in the recent journal Orthopedic Trauma, where she's first author, Retrograde Intramedullary Nailing versus Locked Plating for Extreme Distal Periprosthetic Femur Fractures, a multi-center retrospective cohort study. So really, a title of our episode today is Retrograde IM Nail versus Locked Plating for Extreme Distal Periprosthetic Femur Fractures. It's definitely a problem for those of us who have to manage these. So welcome to the podcast. Thanks for coming.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
Can you tell me how you got interested and involved in the study? Maybe if you can even tell, you know, a case or, you know, personal story, or if not, just how you got into this, in this project.
Sure. So I did my residency at Stanford, which is where I started this project. This started from a conversation that I was having with one of my mentors, Dr. Julius Bishop. We took care of a lot of periprosthetic femur fractures there. And you often hear about this concept of that fracture's too distal to nail. And we were pretty aggressive with intramedullary nailing on the trauma service, but sometimes somebody else would be at a course, or somebody would be taking call on a weekend who wasn't part of the usual trauma rotation. And you keep hearing this concept of what is too distal to nail. And I think it's good to ask yourself where concepts like that came from. And so we started talking about that. And I think that this concept gets back to more or less the early 2000s when the Sioux classification was introduced, which, for those who aren't familiar, describes periprosthetic distal femur fractures according to their location relative to the anterior flange of the total knee. And a Sioux 2 fracture is one that contacts the anterior flange and extends proximal. A Sioux 3 is one that extends distal. And since that classification was introduced, it's been perpetuated in a lot of places that those Sioux 2 and Sioux 3 fractures may be too distal for intramedullary nails. But the nails that were around at that time are different than what we have now. There've been like a lot of advances that allow us to get more points of fixation in really small distal segments, more robust points of fixation, ones that become fixed angle into the nail, et cetera. And so we thought that it would be important to reevaluate this concept and see if it's even still relevant.
Perfect. Let's talk a little bit about the study itself. Can you tell us about the study design? This was obviously a multi-center retrospective study. So how did the actual paper come about, and how did you set it up the way you did? And then maybe tell us what you found.
Yeah. So we immediately went to a multi-center design because we wanted to look specifically at extremely distal fractures. So we needed to cast a wide net in order to capture all those. But we had 8 level 1 trauma centers, all fellowship trained orthopedic traumatologists, and we collected all of their periprosthetic distal femur fractures, which were either a Sioux 2 or a Sioux 3, so contacting the anterior flange and either extending proximal or distal, and treated with fixation. And then we divided all of those. First of all, we excluded dual plates, nail plates, and pathologic fractures. And then we divided those groups into those that were treated with an isolated retrograde nail and those were treated with an isolated locked lateral plate, and then compared outcomes between the two groups. Primary outcome was a reoperation to either promote union or treat infection, basically anything other than a symptomatic, like elective hardware removal. And then secondarily looked at fixation failure, non-union infection, and distal femoral alignment between the groups.
Okay. One of the things you looked at you discussed in your results was being able to weight bear as tolerated. Was there did the centers or the surgeons who were doing plating, you know, just pretty much make a decision, you know, more frequently that those patients were not going to be weight bearing? And that's just sort of, I guess, based on, you know, surgeon preference and sort of traditional post-operative instructions most surgeons have when you plate something rather than nail it. Was that the case? And then I guess I may also follow up and say, you know, given what you know about this, I mean, are they being too conservative when they do that?
Yeah. Absolutely right. Like as a retrospective study, people are going to, it wasn't uniform, but we looked at just what weight bearing prescription was given to patients, and 45% of the retrograde nails were allowed immediate weight bearing, whereas only 9% of the locked plates were allowed immediate weight bearing. So there was a definite, very clear, trend towards, or actually not just a trend, but it's a significant difference in weight bearing protocols between the locked plate group and the nail group. I think that's based on sort of dogma from previous years, but there's some real, I think it still makes good sense to me. Like I personally feel more comfortable allowing patient immediate weight bearing on an intramedullary device than a surface implant on a large long bone, which is going to be asymmetrically loaded, in particular if you have comminution on the medial side. Like it makes sense why surgeons are apprehensive to let people weight bear on an isolated lateral plate.
Okay. What would you say are a couple of major take-home points that the community should take from this study?
Yeah. So our most important finding was that there was no difference in overall reoperation rates between the retrograde nail group and the locked plating group. And when you take out elective symptomatic implant removals, because there were quite a few patients who just went back to have a symptomatic distal interlock removed, which is a very minimally morbid procedure, then the reoperation rate was only 8% in the nail group versus 16% in the locked plating group. Not statistically significantly different, but definitely, you know, trending towards almost potentially being better in the nail group. And so the takeaway from that, I think, is that it appears safe to treat extreme distal fractures with retrograde nailing, and that you should consider that in any fracture where the prosthesis is stable and you have an open box that will accommodate a retrograde nail, because there's at least no difference in reoperation rates, and there seems to be a really clear advantage of earlier weight bearing.
Okay. Did you find that there was a lot of variability in like distal locking technique for the interlocking, for the retrograde nails? Were most cases using multiplanar locking or like more than two screws, or was that, you know, were a lot of the cases just like two distal interlocking screws?
The average number of points of fixation in the distal segment for the nails was 3.5. Versus 6 in the locked plate group. So based on the nails that were being used, I couldn't tell you whether all of them were like fixed angle interlocks, but I do know that people are using advanced retrograde nails that allow for significantly more points of fixation than the old school nails. That still adds up to there being significantly less points of fixation than if you'd used a locked lateral plate. But I think that really just like that emphasizes the message to me that these were, these fractures had fewer points of fixation, they had earlier weight bearing, and they still didn't fail at any higher rate. So I think that just sort of, that, like, just bodes really well for nails, in my opinion.
Yeah. Yeah, I would agree. That would be my takeaway as well. What's been the reception? If you've presented this at a conference or, manuscript reviewers, when you first kind of got comments back, or just in general, for people who've reached out to you about the paper or heard your data.
Yeah, I think the feedback's been really good. I think this is a clinically relevant question for a lot of people, not just traumatologists, but anybody who takes call. It's a really common problem, and it's becoming only more common. So this paper won the Bovell Award for the best paper of the 2022 OTA meeting, and has gotten a fair amount of press related to that.
That's awesome. I think on the topic, you know, talking about distal femur fractures and nail versus plate, nail and plate combos, I think a lot of people would say, okay, well, why choose between a nail and a plate if I'm really, really worried about my fixation? I'm going to do both if I can with a periprosthetic. We can stick to talking about periprosthetic. So wondering what your thoughts, you and the authors, are on that, because I guess a lot of people are going to bring that up. What about nail and plate? What do we know about nail plates and the data?
Yeah. So for this paper, we excluded nail plate combos and dual plates. So the main thing that I think I can say from this paper is that an isolated nail does pretty well. I would not go so far as to say that there's no indication for adding a plate or a dual plate construct. It's really hard to define what patient population needs that. There's just so many factors with regard to bone quality, fracture morphology, patient BMI. If you tell them to weight bear, how much are they actually going to weight bear? That's a huge one. That's like never reported in any kind of like scientifically robust fashion, because it's so hard to track with the tools that we have. When we speak about who needs a nail plate combo versus just an isolated retrograde nail, it's all pretty much level five evidence at this point. But I think that the main takeaway from this paper is that if you're thinking that somebody might need dual plate or a nail plate combo in order to weight bear, ask yourself, could they weight bear on an isolated retrograde nail? Because there were really distal fractures, really comminuted fractures, who were allowed immediate weight bearing on an isolated retrograde nail in this study, and they didn't fail. So that's if I could move the needle in one direction and ask somebody to think about it that way, that would be my main takeaway.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's one of these things. I mean, I'll just say, you know, trends come and go. I'm not saying nail plate's necessarily a trend, but I mean, I think we can say certainly don't have the greatest data yet for it, but it's very popular. And I guess we'll see what happens. Hopefully there will be some data about that. And I think you make a really good point. I mean, if you were able to do nails with these fracture patterns with minimal failure rates, then makes you wonder how often do you need to add plates and what are the criteria to decide when to add a plate. And, you know, I've sort of always thought that we've been very concerned about non-union rates and distal femur fractures with plates being, you know, overly stiff, at least in recent years, and have developed some technologies to avoid that stiffness or alter our techniques. And now we're kind of just adding more fixation, which can't be, it can't make it any less stiff. But I think the argument is, if you need to, if that's going to help you decide that you can weight bear the patient, and you feel more comfortable about letting them weight bear, then I guess that's a reason to do it. And, you know, a lot of the arguments are also being made in distal femur fractures that are not periprosthetic. So, you know, we may be sort of mixing things a little bit here. But I think it's still worth including in the conversation. That being said, what do you think are going to be some future directions for related investigations? I mean, you have a pretty large group here, multi-center trial, a lot of centers involved. Is there anyone or collectively the group feeling that there's a next step or direction that either you guys or someone else should take?
Yeah, I think applying this same question to native periprosthetic distal femur fractures is an area of interest.
You mean like native distal femur fractures?
Like non-periprosthetic. What's too
right, non-periprosthetic, right.
Right, exactly. That's a different patient population usually. So a little bit less osteoporotic. You also, in a periprosthetic, you have the pegs and the cement there, which provide fixation opportunities to like rest interlocks against or potentially drill into the cement. So it becomes a totally different problem when you talk about a non-periprosthetic. It's also a patient population that doesn't have to weight bear for their physiology. So that's a whole separate question that I think needs to be answered. I also really strongly believe that we need better ways of measuring people's weight-bearing behavior in a geriatric population. That's right. Something that our group at Stanford has made a really strong effort to do, but it's proving to be really hard because I had this AO grant and we put sensors into people's shoes for a couple of months. The main lesson from that project is that this population is really, really hard to study. Like so many of our patient population didn't make it to their follow-up because they either died or they moved away or they were too frail to come. They put their sensors in the washing machine. You end up with so much selection bias in the patients who actually make it to clinic that it's hardly even useful. But we're asking all these questions about weight bearing, like how much fixation is safe to let somebody weight bear, or do people weight bear more after fixation or distal femoral replacement, nail versus plate? And we're working on like really shady data. We're just talking about what you told them to do, which we know they don't do, or what they reported they did, which we know is not very true. So I think we need a way to actually quantify in some kind of like reproducible, rigorous fashion. How much walking and weight bearing people are actually doing. And you could take, if you came up with a way to do that, you could apply that to all the questions that we ask about distal femur fractures and get better answers.
And for other fractures, other lower extremity fractures too, that we wonder about. I mean, distal femur is a great example. I mean, a lot of people make the argument, well, you know, to an elderly patient with a bad distal femur, I'm just going to do a distal femoral replacement because they're going to weight bear right away. Well, the question, I mean, do they really weight bear right away after surgery like that? Like, how much are you really like, are you really just getting up and walking like you were before? I mean, that's, you know, you don't know. Probably not.
Yeah, probably not.
Anyway. Well, I think we're out of time. I think we covered a lot, and I think that it's a great topic. We, you know, we talked about a couple of sort of tangential stuff, but I think that, you know, the main paper is still very interesting, a lot to learn. But I think I want to just highlight the paper again. It's retrograde intramedullary nailing versus lock plating for extreme distal periprosthetic femur fractures, a multi-center retrospective cohort study. This is in the Journal of Orthopedic Trauma, February 2024. And the first author is Dr. Noelle Van Rijsselberghe. And I've been speaking with her on the call today. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.